From NPR News, this is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The twists and turns in this presidential race just keep on coming. Republican presidential candidate John McCain announced yesterday that he is suspending his campaign and was returning to Washington today to help hammer out a plan to fix the economy. In the meantime, he says he is cutting all ads and he wants to postpone Friday's debate with Senator Barack Obama. Obama says he intends to go ahead with the debate. For the latest, we have NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Hello, Ron.
Good to be with you, Tony.
Can you explain, Ron, how this happened and why McCain decided to suspend his campaign?
Well, we can only speculate as to why he suspended his campaign or what exactly that means in his mind. It is not clear at this hour what has in fact been suspended. He did not appear on David Letterman last night, but he did do an interview with Katie Couric last night. He has spent the morning in New York at a political event with Bill Clinton. They were celebrating bipartisanship. It was a positive event, but it was also something, obviously, that was good for John McCain's presidential campaign. He just arrived in Washington a little over an hour ago, and was going to go to his Senate office and start to get involved, see what he could do to try to bring the various factions together and get something going with respect to this bailout plan. But now, just in the past few minutes, we have had a tentative announcement from the Democrats and Republicans who have been negotiating on this nonstop 4 days while the candidates have been out on the campaign trail, that they think they have a fundamental agreement, that they have the basis for a deal, and that they're going to continue to work and they're going to continue to fine-tune it. And I'm sure there are going to be many more developments, but that they believe they already do have an agreement that would pass the bailout.
Yesterday, both candidates, Barack Obama and John McCain, sounded very similar in their reactions and responses to the bailout, suggesting that their concerns were that there be oversight, that the taxpayers be protected, and that the bankers not be rewarded. Is there any indication of what their positions are today with regard to it?
I believe that that joint statement that came about 12 hours after the initial phone call from Barack Obama to John McCain suggesting they issue one did include all those issues. And I believe that all those issues will be addressed to some degree, if not really solved, by whatever this bailout agreement turns out to be. They're going to talk about there being more oversight. They're going to set up ways in which Congress will be involved. They're going to set up ways to limit the compensation of executives on Wall Street, particularly those for companies that are failing. They are going to have a number of protections. They're going to try to do a better job of regulating this time. But the main thing that the bailout is probably going to establish is that the money is there to save these financial institutions, to essentially indemnify everyone from damage from these toxic mortgage loans, these mortgage loans gone bad, and that the era in which we move towards ever and ever greater deregulation of the financial markets is over, and we're going to be going 180 degrees the other direction.
Let's go back and talk about the suspended campaign for a moment. What is the practical effect of that on the race for the White House?
I suspect that the main effect it's had thus far is to get everyone talking about John McCain and how he has a tendency to shake things up again, which is a big part of John McCain's campaign persona, his narrative, if you will, that he is a fellow who is inclined to do the unexpected, to move between the parties, to move on his own, to be a maverick, to be unpredictable, to throw the long ball, if you like, and sometimes that can really change things. Now, I think the McCain campaign may be telling us in the hours to come that just the shift in emphasis over the last 24 hours since he talked about suspending his campaign, it's been a little less than 24 hours since the mid-afternoon announcement that he wanted to do that on Wednesday, that just that alone changed the atmosphere in Washington. And even before he returned to Washington, the fruits of that were visible. That's obviously going to be a debatable proposition. I think a lot of people are going to relate to this as having been a kind of campaign device that had very little effect on the actual bailout negotiations. But those two sides will contend.
I have less than 30 seconds for your answer. And the question is it fair to ask whether or not Sarah Palin could have continued campaigning?
Well, I don't think that there's really been much of a change even in John McCain's own schedule. I don't know of anything he dropped from his schedule other than that one interview with David Letterman, and I haven't seen a change in Sarah Palin's schedule. But all this may be moot if, in fact, the conditions for resuming John McCain's campaign are being met by the negotiators on Capitol Hill.
Ron, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Tony.
That was NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. He joined us from our studios in Washington, D.C. Here to continue the discussion on the campaign and on the financial crisis is Melissa Harris-Lacewell now, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University, and Robert Trainum. He is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. Welcome, both of you.
Great to be here.
So you just heard what Ron Elving had to say about the possibility of a resolution of this bailout crisis that's taking place in the nation's capital. You also heard us talk about the fact that John McCain has suspended his campaign amid questions as to whether or not his goal was to help himself politically or to help the country. Robert Trainor, how do you see it?
Well, you know, Senator McCain, no one questions his patriotism. He obviously has put country first, to use his terminology, over the last couple of centuries, or centuries, over the last couple of days since he has been in the public eye. However, he's also a politician, and so we also need to look at him in that lens as well. And so we need to understand that although he has put his presidential campaign on hold for the next couple of days or however long it's going to be, he's also still running for president. And so we just need to understand that and recognize moving forward that if, in fact, something does materialize with this bipartisan agreement that hopefully will happen later on today, if not today, sometime tomorrow, that he probably will use this and use it fairly effectively as he runs for the presidency over the next 3 weeks.
How long do you think, Melissa, that the campaign is likely to be suspended? He said that if there is an agreement on the bailout bill that he'll be ready to debate on Friday, but is that likely?
Well, given that Barack Obama is planning to debate on Friday, I think it's a really good idea for John McCain to come. So I suspect that he will. I think that more than anything, this was sort of a positioning of John McCain as someone who would sort of, you know, drop everything, particularly drop the pursuit of a personal goal of being president in order to address the questions of country. It was his opportunity to actually enact that notion of country first. But I think the big question here is whether or not there was, in fact, a suspension of the campaign. If anything, there's a sort of heightened conversation about John McCain and his role as a presidential candidate in this moment. So that by saying he's not campaigning, he actually drives media attention toward the fact that he is running for president at exactly the moment when the public opinion polls are swinging towards Barack Obama. So it was really quite an interesting strategic choice that had exactly the effect of giving his little campaign a bit of a boost.
Well, you know, one of the interesting side effects potentially of this, Robert, is that during the Republican convention, it appeared to many in the media and others that John McCain was doing his level best not to be seen to be too close to the Bush White House. And yet here he is now in a situation where he will be very close to the president over the next 24 hours, presumably.
Well, yes and no. I mean, let's put this in context. The context is that this country is in deep, deep financial mess, and that we only have one president at one time, and that just so happens to be George W. Bush. So regardless of whether or not, you know, you want to distance yourself from him or not, he's still relevant, he meaning George Bush, and you have to work with him in that context. And so, and it's not only just John McCain working with George W. Bush, it's Nancy Pelosi, it's Barack Obama. Let's remember that Senator Obama is scheduled to meet with the president as well to discuss this bipartisan solution to this problem. So I guess to be fair to this conversation, we really need to understand that the president is still relevant, although he's unpopular, he's still relevant in the context of trying to get us out of this financial mess.
Now, one of the things that I talked about with Ron Elving a few moments ago was the fact that yesterday Obama and McCain both sounded very similar in their approaches to the bailout package. There did not appear to be much difference between them. Is there any that is distinctive in your mind, Melissa?
Well, I think one thing that's distinctive is that John McCain does seem to be acting in this moment as though this economic crisis is a new crisis or an unforeseen one. The kind of suspension of the campaign resounds like the suspension or the scaling back of the GOP convention when the hurricane was coming ashore on the Gulf Coast. Obviously, you can't predict a hurricane more than a few days out, so it was an unpredictable event. But in the context of this economic crisis, this is actually the warning signs for this have been coming down the road for quite a while. In fact, News and Notes has been doing an incredibly good job over the past 6 or 7 months really detailing the economic crisis as it is emerging. And Barack Obama was saying this, has been saying this since the primary campaign, that we were in an economic crisis, and John McCain consistently was saying that we were not. So if there is a difference, I think the difference had to do within the sense of judgment about what was coming down the road.
Let me ask you, Robert Tranum, as we bring the conversation to a close, what happens now? What do you think that is the next best move for John McCain? How long should he continue in this suspended mode before he gets back officially onto the campaign trail?
You know, I got to tell you, Tony, regardless of when the House and the Senate and the White House come to an agreement, and because they will, I mean, there's no question about that they will come to an agreement sooner rather than later. John McCain actually rhetorically has the upper hand on this because he can then say, again, I put my country first, number one. Number two, I actually suspended everything to fly back to Washington, D.C., because this was not only important to me, but it's also very important to the millions of Americans out there. So I think just from a drama standpoint and also from a rhetorical standpoint, he will have the upper hand on this and says, I actually practice what I preach. I put my self-interest aside for the best interest of the country. Now, granted, some people will look at that and say, well, that was nothing but just for partisan sake. But I got to tell you, regardless of whether it's for partisan sake or not, to actually put your presidential campaign on hold and to stop all advertising and to stop campaigning as little or as much as he may have been scheduled to do today and tomorrow and the next day, he actually has done it. And you got to give him at least credit for that.
All right, we've got to stop right there. Thank you very much, Robert and Melissa.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was Robert Tranum. He is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network CN8. And Melissa Harris-Lacewell, she's an Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University.
I know you don't smoke weed. I know this. But I'm going to get you high today. Because it's Friday, you ain't got no job, and you ain't shit to do.
That was comedian Chris Tucker speaking to rapper Ice Cube in the comedy Friday, where marijuana plays a large part in the plot line. And this is what we're discussing today as we conclude our series on addiction. We look at how the media portrays dependency. Joining me now is Dan Partland. He is the executive producer on the reality show Intervention on the A&E Network. And also Howard Samuels. He is a doctorate in clinical psychology and is executive director of the Wonderland Center, a residential addiction treatment facility in Los Angeles. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Samuels, let me begin with you. And I've been thinking about this question, and I'd like to ask you this. Does the media accurately portray addiction, in your opinion, and does it have a responsibility to do so?
Well, first of all, the media does not portray addiction in its correct light. And I do believe it has a huge responsibility. And where the media is, you know, being irresponsible is that the only time that we're really talking about the crisis, the drug crisis in this country, which is at epidemic proportions, is when a celebrity gets arrested. And then we're all talking about that particular celebrity and what's wrong with Hollywood, which I think is totally irresponsible, because what Hollywood represents is America. And what is happening here is happening in the rest of the country. And when you want to talk about film, you know, all you got to do is look at that great movie, Knocked Up, where, you know, it's so funny with, you know, those guys smoking pot every day and being totally blitzed. And, you know, it's funny, but it's sad, because so much of our youth today are doing exactly that.
Let me bring Dan Partland into the conversation. He's in the studio here with me. Dan, you're the executive producer on Intervention, a show that attempts to help people with addiction. But before we ask you the same question that I just put to Dr. Samuels, here's a short clip from your show leading up to the intervention of one of the participants.
Asa blames my parents for his bulimia and his alcoholism.
Every time I would get seconds, oh, you're going to get another plate, Ace.
Okay, you know, I'm not the perfect dad. Maybe
no,
I thought I was doing right, and I wasn't.
I honestly, I don't want your guys' help.
So here's the question. Does the media have that responsibility, and is that what you try to address with your show?
I think it does. Our effort in intervention, though, is not to broadly just moralize about drinking and drug use. Our effort is really to try to focus the problem on addiction and abuse. The reason for that is that I think that the Just Say No era is kind of run its course. Just Say No is not, it's a good catchphrase, but it's not sophisticated enough to really point families at how to address the problem, which I think comes from understanding the roots of the problem, which frequently is family behavior and patterns, sometimes trauma from early childhood, or something as simple as low self-esteem.
How difficult is it to put together something like your program because what you're dealing with is so very personal?
Well, it's a very difficult show to produce. One of the criteria that we use for selecting stories for the show really is, first and foremost, that it's somebody who's completely comfortable to share their problem. It's the complete frankness of our participants that's one of the real hallmarks of the show, and it's quite shocking to see sometimes on television. I think A&E has been very courageous in putting this kind of material on TV, but putting this kind of material on TV really is the antidote to some of the glamorized images that appear in other kinds of tabloid media.
Dr. Samuels, you know, with images of addiction on television and in radio and in print, as we've been discussing so far today, what impact has this had on ordinary people seeking treatment? Do you think it's made it easier, more acceptable, or more difficult?
Well, I think that, you know, when you have shows like Intervention that show the reality of the damage of drug and alcohol use, okay, it makes it easier because you want to take the shame out of the issue. And, you know, it's such a widespread issue in our communities and in our families today that, you know, one of the problems has always been people have lived in the shadows and have lived in denial. And we want to take away that shame and that denial and make it okay for people to say, yes, I have a problem. I need help. And, you know, we've got to go from family to family in order to educate. And the only way to do that is through medias just like we're doing right now today.
Well, you know, let me put this to the both of you, and I'll come to you first, Dan. Is there, in your view, a cultural difference in the way addiction is shown in the media? And here's where I'm coming from. In African-American films and in African-American television sometimes, and in movies that show African-American characters, drug use and drug abuse is shown openly, while often in other movies, the message appears to be at times wrapped in comedy and less offensive, I suppose would be one word you could use.
Well, for sure that I think that the depiction in different communities is probably links back to how those communities have been affected by the drug use. But I do think that there's a maturation going on in the culture right now in terms of how we see it. I think that the era of connecting, for instance, crack use to a lot of urban poor and along racial lines as well, I suspect is being broadened now that we see that meth has sort of similarly decimated rural poor communities. So that both are kind of, you know, addiction, one of the things is that it cuts across all social strata. One of our express missions in intervention is to choose stories that defy the stereotypes in terms of how it's already portrayed in the media, because the statistics are something like 22 million Americans suffer from a drug and alcohol addiction. So that's just less than one out of every 100 of us. And fewer than 10% of those are really getting help right now. So we definitely want to make the point that we're, you know, that addiction cuts across all strata, and it's important for everybody to get help for it.
Do you see that in media, Dr. Samuels? And I'm thinking now about shows like Weeds on Showtime, which depicts a white suburban housewife selling marijuana and living a otherwise perfectly normal life.
Well, I do believe what Dan said. You know, at Wonderland, I mean, we see, you know, everybody, you know, that cross all economic and ethnic lines. I mean, you know, I used to smoke crack. I used to shoot heroin. And I'm 24 years clean and sober. And I came from an upper middle class family in New York. You know, I have housewives that come into treatment that, you know, are smoking crack and have babies, and or other housewives that are, you know, dependent on, you know, Percocet and Percodan. You know, so, you know, it really does cross, you know, that's the amazing thing about addiction. It doesn't discriminate, okay? And that to me is what is really sort of the issue that across the board. And you know, the media does their stereotypes and tries to make light of it, and it's not funny.
What impact, if any, Dr. Samuels, did you think that the media may have played in your addiction or in your recovery?
Well, you know, I know that for, you know, when I was arrested in New York, and I was arrested in 1969, 1971, my father was running for governor of New York. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, here I am, just, you know, a kid going to school, and all of a sudden I find myself on the front page of the Daily News and, you know, the front story of every news column in the New York Times and picture in Newsweek. And, you know, I had my 15 minutes of fame. And the interesting thing about that was that, you know, I had to sort of recover in public. I mean, I had to sort of, you know, wear my shame out in public. And in the one way, it was unfortunate because, you know, there was no privacy to my recovery. But in another way, it sort of, I couldn't hide from the problem. I had to take responsibility for the problem. And so it did help me, it did help motivate me, if you can understand that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes, by the way. I'm Tony Cox. And if you're just tuning in, we are talking about how addiction is portrayed in pop culture. We're talking with Howard Samuels, a clinical psychologist and the executive director of the Wonderland Center, a residential addiction treatment facility here in Los Angeles, and Dan Partland, who is executive producer of the reality show Intervention on the A&E Network. Dan, you said something earlier I want to go back to. You talked about cultural maturation. And I'm thinking now, and my question is having to do with generational issues, because from, you know, Woodstock and Peace and Love and in the old days of drug use to now, how has that impacted how we look at and think about drug addiction as a society?
Well, I think that the days, I mean, if you really track the evolution of that, you know, the days of the rat pack and glamorizing drunkenness and stuff like that, I think that, you know, we've moved from that through the 60s era. Maybe there was something in the 80s too about, you know, glamour and cocaine use on Wall Street and things like that. But I actually think that the current climate is more about what's going on in the tabloids, which is a real fascination with addiction, relapse, and recovery. My sister got me a T-shirt that she was seeing people wear in New York City, and it says, "Rehab is the new black." And I think that that's kind of evidence of where we're at. It's a part of the fashion of the time, and I wonder if we should be bemoaning that the part of it that's about drug use, or maybe just celebrating that at least rehab has become part of the equation.
You know, we've talked a lot about media and the impact of it, radio, television, and print. We haven't talked yet, Dr. Samuels, about the Internet, because that is actually the newest, fastest, most impactful form of media that we have. How has that impacted our view of addiction?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. I mean, first of all, the Internet has been a great drug pusher with because you can actually buy prescription drugs illegally so much easier on the Internet. But, you know, there's a new drug called Selvia that, you know, is unfortunately legal in most of the country, and you can buy it over the Internet, and it's sold over the Internet. But also there is videos on YouTube about kids smoking it and hallucinating and losing body control and motor skills. And that has sort of spread like wildfire. And it wouldn't have spread like wildfire if it wasn't for the actual publicity of it on YouTube and all those videos. So because we live in such an age where it's sort of instantaneous trends and new fads and new drugs, I think it adds tremendous good and bad to this issue.
Does a show like yours, Dan, have a shelf life in terms of what will be acceptable and interesting for an audience?
I don't think so. I suspect not, because I think that a lot of what the show focuses on is the collateral damage of the addiction. Addiction, you know, people will always debate whether their aunt or uncle or whoever has to have a cocktail every night, whether that's really an alcoholic or not. We try to focus on what the negative consequences are. If you're losing all your relationships and you're having financial distress and chaos in your life, then probably you have an addiction. Those problems tend to be what the show focuses on, because that's really where the problem lives. The problem lives in all the collateral damage. It's not just about when the person is getting high. I think most of those issues are fairly universal and timeless.
Another question for you is this. I would think that interventions would actually be, even though an intervention itself is an incident, but that there is a longer timeline involving a recovery. And I don't know if your show allows for that.
Well, the show, it's true, the show mostly tells the story of the problem and tries to get into the roots of the problem, and then shows a family trying to address the problem by getting someone into treatment. And then the show follows up on that person usually 3 or 4 months later when they're getting out of treatment, and people always ask, you know, what happened in between? You know, now they seem happy and well-adjusted and they're in recovery and they're very excited by it. I think it's very sticky, because the issues that come up in treatment are very, very hard to depict fairly in the media. Some of them are very private and wouldn't really be appropriate to be explored on camera. We do try to give insight into what treatment and recovery is all about along the way in the show, but ultimately is just very hard to show on television.
My final question is for you, Doctor, and it's this. Do you think that there is a timeline that is predictable in terms of recovery or in terms of treatments for someone who is addicted?
You mean a timeline as far as their recovery is concerned?
Yeah. Well, in other words, if you have an intervention or you get involved with someone to try to help them, can you generally anticipate how long it might take to get that person out of their addiction?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a process. I mean, I know that for me, my family intervened on me, and they had to intervene numerous times over a matter of years in order to stop enabling me. And I think there's a process to it. But, you know, I think that what families have to do is they can't give up. They've got to keep on going after their loved one and continue the interventions as much as possible in order to help their loved one, because, you know, I wouldn't be on the phone right now talking to you if it wasn't for my family saving my life by doing intervention on me.
There is help out there, and I think that that's one of our missions for the show, is to tell people that so they go out there and they look for it. A&E is doing a part of our public information mission. They're doing the recovery rally in New York on Saturday, September 27th. It's all part of an awareness raising and trying to connect people with resources so people know there is help.
Final thing for you, Dan. I've got about 15 seconds or so for you to answer. For the people that you do interventions on your show, how many of them recover and how many of them don't?
We actually have great results on the show. I think the three interventionists who do interventions for us also have a private practice, but the results tend to be even better for the show. We've done at this point about 102 interventions. All but two of them agreed to go to treatment. The vast majority of those finished treatment, and at last check, 77 of them were sober.
That's a good deal. Thank you, gentlemen, both, for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Dr. Howard Samuels, Executive Director of the Wonderland Center, a residential treatment facility for addiction, and Dan Partland, the executive producer of the reality TV show Intervention on the A&E Network. He joined me here in our studios at NPR West. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. It's Thursday, and here at News and Notes, that means we get to talk about sports. And since it's late September, well, that means we'll be talking a lot about football. Here to help us grind out the gridiron news, Kevin Figures. He blogs about sports for AM570radio.com. And Chad Brown, he writes for AlphaBlogSports.blogspot.com. Guys, nice to have you back.
Good to be back, Tony. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing, Chad?
Doing well, thanks.
All right. We're going to talk football to start with, and we're going to go from the boys to the men, if that's okay with you guys. And we're going to talk about some of the odd things that are happening in football, and not so nice, actually. Misbehaving would be one way to describe it. We're in the thick of football season at the moment, so there's a lot of news coming from the gridiron. The Young Bucks, I said, last Friday, for example, in suburban Washington, D.C., a football game ended in the third quarter when one of the coaches pulled his team off the field. His players say they were subjected to racial slurs from the other team. The Maryland Attorney General's office is, in fact, investigating right now. You heard about this, Kevin. Were you surprised when you saw this?
I was very surprised by it. It's not something that you really see a lot often, you know, today. I mean, you hear about, you know, there are racial tensions. And even at the same high school, I read that earlier in the last year, there were racial tensions between certain students with the Confederate flag and what have you. But it's not something you expect to see in today's world, you know.
That's absolutely true. And this is the Northeast, Chad. You're in the Northeast. Is this the kind of thing that you guys have happened up there?
No, it's not. I mean, not at that level. I mean, I played high school growing up in the New York, New Jersey area, and I've never encountered anything quite like it. It's a sad commentary, and that it's not the first time something like this has happened is even more disturbing. If they want to write it off as trash talking, I think we all have a different definition of trash talking than they do. It's very disturbing, and I feel bad for this next team that's debating whether or not to go play on the field.
Absolutely right, and we're going to go from bad to worse with this next story, because last Friday right here in Los Angeles, shots rang out in a school parking lot at the end of a football game. One of the two victims had been a star on that team last year. Kevin, I'm turning to you first because you actually attended that high school, George Washington Preparatory High School in South L.A. What is going on? Is it not safe to go to a high school football game in Los Angeles anymore?
I mean, it's been that way for a while. I mean, I hate to say it because that is my school. It's my alma mater. I love this school and I love the area, but that place has been really riddled with like gang violence and things of that nature for years. Even before I went there, I saw it when I did go there. I was in there, producer, earlier. I saw a student get shot down 20 feet away from me when I was a student at the high school. It's a really bad situation. I love the administrators. They work as hard as they can to make the environment as safe as they possibly can. But when you have something like that, and then especially something like you said, as a football game that's supposed to be a safe haven, something that gets kids away from the streets and things of that nature, it's really an unfortunate situation.
Well, when you were at the school, when things like this were happening, where people were being shot at games and in other situations, did it make you not want to go or make you not go to the stadium, to a game, because of the danger?
At times it did. And because, like I said, because I loved my friends, I loved a lot of the administrators, I loved everything about the school. The problem was the things around the school, outside of the school, that kind of made you not want to go. But there are things inside the school that you love so much. But then when the surroundings are so bad, it's kind of a tough situation.
Chad, can you imagine that kind of a danger at a high school football game?
None that I've attended, but I have heard about it. It's unfortunate and it's sad, but that's not the first time I've heard of something like that happening. Nothing I've ever witnessed or anything happening at any school I attended. But it's a sad commentary when these two things get mixed up. One shouldn't be happening regardless of the venue, but to happen at a football game, I pretty much agree with everything Kevin said.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, this is not to say that there are problems at football games all over the country. Certainly they are not. The vast majority of them, I'm certain, are, you know, they're fun to go to. Even in Los Angeles, you can go to certain games in certain areas and not have any problems, but the reality is that certain areas you may have a problem. Here's another story out of high school that's also disturbing. The entire coaching staff of Robertson High School's football team, this is in New Mexico, has resigned after it came to light that they had turned a blind eye to a particularly graphic hazing incident during preseason training camp. Six players on that football team are accused of sodomizing younger teammates with a broomstick, and the coaches turning a blind eye, as I said to it. That's just, it's crazy, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, it's something unheard of, and we all know about hazing. I mean, when I played football, I was hazed, but there's a difference between, you know, shaving somebody's head or doing all the, you know, the stuff in the jockstrap and all that. But to do something like that to one of your teammates, that's embarrassing for the community, the school, all the students, you know. It's and then like they said, the cheerleaders and other people from the school have to deal with all of these, you know, these slurs and chants and such at different events. It's a bad situation all around, and no student should have to deal with that kind of thing.
You know, Chad, I know these may be isolated incidents, or are they part of a larger cultural malaise that we're experiencing?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, because when I read all these stories, especially the last one, I was just stunned. I'd never heard of anything like this happening, even in movies where they mock sports or mock these things like that. But it very well could be an epidemic of a larger very well could be part of a larger epidemic.
Of a larger problem. All right, let's move up to the college level. Top-ranked University of Southern California facing Oregon State tonight. Trojans coming off romps over Virginia and Ohio State. Are they going to run the table, Chad, do you think? I'll ask you, because Kevin's here in Southern California. We don't want to seem biased.
No, understood. It's very possible. They've looked great in their first two games, but now they're starting in the Pac-10, and even Pete Carroll has come on and said this is not going to be a cakewalk. But I haven't seen anything that leads me to believe that they can't run the table. Now, crazy things can happen. We still have a long way to go, but they look very good right now. On the other hand, Oregon is coming off of a convincing win against Hawaii, so they'll probably look at this as a statement game. If they can beat them or slow them down, it would be huge for them. But I don't see anything stopping USC.
Well, USC certainly had its troubles up in Corvallis, Oregon. But looking at the AP and the coaches' polls right now, Kevin figures USC number one, Oklahoma number two, Georgia consensus number three, Florida number four. AP has LSU at the five spot, and the coaches' poll has Missouri in the number five spot. Do you see any of them overtaking USC?
I don't see it, especially if USC runs the table. A lot of people are talking about how bad the Pac-10 has been this year and how that maybe hurt USC. But if USC continues to be as dominant as they have been the first couple of weeks of the season, I don't see there's any way that they get jumped unless they have another Stanford game like last year and lose somewhere in conference where they shouldn't have. That they should have no problem going to the national championship game this year.
All right, we'll see how it goes. Let's move on to the big boys, the NFL, and they have had some of their problems this year. There are some teams that haven't done so well. Let's see, Detroit, Cleveland, Kansas City. I know they haven't won a game yet. Oh, you can throw Cincinnati in there. You can throw who else did I mention? Did I say Cincinnati already?
You did say Cincinnati.
All right. St. Louis.
St. Louis, that's the other one. They haven't won a game, although Cincinnati and Cleveland, Kevin figures one of those guys is going to win this week because they're playing each other.
Absolutely, unless there's a tie. Well, I don't see that happening. But yeah, it's been bad quarterback play on both sides for those teams. You just don't understand. I mean, the Cleveland Browns were one of the best offenses in the NFL last year. They won 10 games. There's a lot of debate of how good the Browns really were because 7 of those 10 wins last year came against teams with under 500 records.
Mm-hmm.
So they've never been that really great defensively, but you expected them to do a lot more offensively this season. And there was debate up until today whether or not Brady Quinn would actually become the starter this week, and Romeo Crennel did come out and say that Derek Anderson is going to keep his starting job.
Yeah, but if he doesn't play well, he's going to yank him before that game is over. You can count on that. Hey, Chad, let me ask you this. It looks like a couple of the teams who have not won at all, Kansas City and St. Louis, are going to continue that because Kansas City is going up against Denver. They haven't lost, and St. Louis is going up against Buffalo, and they haven't lost.
I just feel bad for the entire state of Missouri right about now, but I would have to agree. I don't see any progress coming from Kansas. The best thing I can say about Kansas City is they had a great draft, but they're probably not going to see the benefits of that for a couple of years. And immediately, St. Louis has announced they're going to put Trent Green in, which I've seen him play great before, but coming off of those concussions, I mean, this reeks of desperation. I think both cases they'd be better off just wiping the slate clean and starting from scratch. I don't really see any. At least Kansas City showed some signs of life against New England without Brady, but I haven't seen a thing from the Rams that convinces me they can turn this thing around.
I think that the NFC East matchup this week is the big game in the National Football League. Washington and Dallas. Washington 2-1, Dallas undefeated. That's a big game, though, for that division, isn't it, Kevin?
It's a huge game. That's probably the best division in the NFL this entire year. And so I believe there's only one team, the Eagles, that missed the playoffs last season, and they were 8-8. So it's going to be really tough to, you know, you have to get as many division wins as you can in that division, and it's going to be tough for the Washington Redskins. They looked good last week against Arizona, but there's a difference between playing Arizona and playing the Dallas Cowboys, who've looked unbeatable at times this year.
Before we leave football, we've got to talk very briefly about the Oakland Raiders and also about the Detroit Lions, because Matt Millen, who a former Raider, by the way, who won two Super Bowl rings with them and has been the president of the Lions for, what, 7 years now? At their record, 31-84, Chad, and he finally got the boot yesterday. Is that, like, too late?
Well, it's never too late. I'll say this about Matt Millen. For a GM, he was a heck of a broadcaster. But I don't know. I mean, this really should have happened a long time. This really should have happened a long time ago. It seemed like, and I'm pardon the pun, it seemed like he was trying to fill the first receiver offense with all the picks that he made. It just, and as I read somewhere today, firing him is a big step, but you still have the same brain trust that brought him in still running the show, and the same brain trust that took 8 years to make this decision still running this show. So I still think it's going to get a lot worse for Detroit before it gets better. But getting rid of Matt Millen was a necessary step, although bringing him in at the time, there was a lot of head scratching, and the heads were still scratching at the beginning of the season. To lose to the offensive coordinator that you fired the week before, that had to be
good.
The bottom of the barrel.
Absolutely. All right, gentlemen, a moment of silence, please. For the demise, the end, the closing, the tearing down of the venerable Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. Yankee Stadium closing after 85 years, the team moving across the street to its brand new home. Yankee team captain Derek Jeter had an emotional speech after the final game on Sunday. Here he is.
It's a lot of tradition, a lot of history, and a lot of memories. Now, the great thing about memories is you're able to pass it along from generation to generation. And although things are going to change next year, we're going to move across the street, there are a few things with the New York Yankees that never change. That's pride, it's tradition, and most of all, we have the greatest fans in the world.
Well, we've got to end with this, Chad. I know one thing that's changed for the New York Yankees. You know what it is?
They're not in the playoffs.
That's absolutely correct. Not going to the postseason and going home early. And if they don't make some changes, they won't be back to the postseason anytime soon, will they, Kevin?
No. They have to fix that pitching staff. That pitching staff was an embarrassment this year. Their offense has been there, but they couldn't pitch. And if you can't pitch, you can't win in the major leagues.
In fact, you know what? We may not have a New York team in the postseason this year. The Mets are their closest shot, and they're right now tied with Milwaukee for the wild card spot. Do you think, Chad, really quick, that the Mets are going to make it?
I want to say yes, but judging off of last year, there are no guarantees.
What do you say, Kevin?
I don't think the Mets will make it. Their bullpen is shot. It's when they lost Billy Wagner, that was the end of it for them.
Who you like in the World Series?
I like the Angels.
The Cubbies?
Angels and Cubs.
Angels and Cubs. Gentlemen, I appreciate having you in. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Kevin Figures blogs about sports for AM570Radio.com. Chad Brown writes for AlphaBlogSports.blogspot.com. They joined me, Kevin did, at our studios here in NPR West, and Chad is in New York at our NPR studios there. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. How's it going?
It's going great, thanks. So it sounds like letters about politics and the economy are stuffing this week's mailbox.
That's right. On Monday, we discussed the proposed economic bailout on our Bloggers Roundtable. Becky Erickson in St. Louis, Missouri, wrote in after she heard this.
And what would you advise, say, someone in your family to do right now with their money?
The mattress. The sugar bowl up in the top cabinet.
Becky wrote, in this volatile economic environment, it is socially irresponsible to get fired up about the issues and pass sarcastic opinion. None of the panel members likely utilize a cookie jar off as credible. While I typically enjoyed the passion and strong perspectives on your program, last night I was horrified. Please think of us, your anxiety-ridden listeners, who look to you for sound opinion the next time you jokingly offer regressive financial advice. Let me just say that Jasmine Canick is a blogger and not a financial analyst. We do have financial analysts on our show regularly, and they do offer sound advice.
We also got pinged a few times for another Bloggers Roundtable topic. Last week, the bloggers discussed GOP VP pick Sarah Palin and diversity after it was reported that the Alaska governor had never participated in a Juneteenth Emancipation Day celebration. Megan Hopkins in Statesboro, Georgia, wrote us this.
My ears perked up when I heard the roundtable talking about Sarah Palin and race issues in her own state. When lack of participation in Juneteenth was mentioned, I laughed out loud. I was born and raised in Alaska, and I can say from experience that there are no African Americans in Alaska. That's what it seems like anyway. I'm white, by the way. I had never heard of Juneteenth until I went to college in Chicago.
Then some of our music-savvy listeners wrote in after we quoted these lyrics for a segment on sex and love addiction.
Sex is natural, sex is fun, sex is best when it's fun.
We incorrectly attributed the song to the group Wham!, but Douglas Benjamin in Austin, Texas, caught our mistake. He wrote, "The song was actually a post-Wham! Solo effort from George Michael, showing my age and pointless knowledge, too, but I couldn't help but mention the error." Thanks for keeping us honest, Doug.
Then Dennis Aiello of Coconut Creek, Florida, sent some love. He wrote,
"Tony Cox is a breath of fresh air. Why? He asks short, direct questions and listens. He does not ask the question, then answer it, then ask it again in the same way with more words. Please give me more of this guy." And to be fair and balanced about our hosts, here's a letter from Scylla Selden, who wrote,
"Just wanted to say I just discovered the show and host Farai Chidea recently on my Sirius radio and that I really enjoy the show and her interviewing. Thanks for a great show."
And thanks for your letters. Please keep your comments coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thanks for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.